going to call it an evening. Thank you very much, and holla.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, March 4th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen The Great Muppet Caper, where Kermit the Frog, the Great Gonzo, and Fozzie Bear are reporters for the Daily Chronicle, traveling to Britain to report on the theft of the baseball diamond. This week's screening benefits the Circus Project. Again, that's The Great Muppet Caper, showing Monday, March 4th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Prison Pipeline with Hard Knock Radio at 7.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Welcome to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Mumia Abu-Jamal, a former black nationalist and public radio reporter, in 1982 was sentenced to death for the killing of a Philadelphia police officer. For the next 30 years, Mumia was held in solitary confinement on Pennsylvania's death row. In 2011, his sentence was commuted to life without parole. Mumia maintains his innocence, and requests for a new trial have been continually denied. My guest is Noelle Hanrahan, founder of Prison Radio. Noelle is a journalist who has been recording and broadcasting Abu-Jamal's commentaries for almost 30 years. Welcome, Noelle. Welcome to Prison Pipeline.
I'm really glad to be here.
So, Noelle, where is Mumia currently? Where is he being held?
Mumia is being held at SCI Mahanoy, which is about 2 hours from Philadelphia. It's northeast. It's probably approximately 2 hours also from New York City in the state of Pennsylvania. And it's a medium security prison, and he's doing life imprisonment without possibility of parole.
Is he having contact visits at this point?
Mumia is in general population. He has a security distinction, so he has some restrictions on his movements within this prison, but he gets access to general population regulations. In each prison is different. For this prison, he gets 2 visits per week, and he gets also visits from that don't count against the visiting list, from legal people and from his spiritual advisor. So he gets regular visits at this prison. He gets the ability to use the phone, but they have a lot of different restrictions that have been coming in waves in Pennsylvania. So Pennsylvania is really at the forefront of taking away prisoners' rights and prisoners' accommodations that they use inside to either access the courts or access their family. So just to say that, yes, he has access to people and the phone, they are continually trying to remove prisoners from our consciousness and really lock them away and hide them away. You know, in 2014, we filed a lawsuit to make sure that Mumia could use pencils, paper, and the phone to communicate with people as a writer. That was a law that was passed, that was signed by the governor, that we had to go to federal court to actually overturn. Recently, they have taken away all direct mail to the prison from families, and also they have circumscribed people's ability to communicate with their lawyers. So now legal mail is conducted in such a way that most lawyers don't feel comfortable sending it in. So they've really interrupted this Sixth Amendment right that prisoners have to access to the courts while also taking away any cards, any photos. They shut down the visiting rooms. They took away photos for 6 months that you can take inside the prison, anything that they can do to dehumanize prisoners. Now, I say that, and it's been proven. The papers here, which are not favorable to prisoners necessarily, have stated unequivocally that the reasons they were using to force through these draconian rules were actually false. So it's not a pretty picture. I'm just trying to say, yes, these in general population, Pennsylvania is an extraordinarily restrictive prison system.
I think it's remarkable that you gain access to the prison and are able to record his commentaries on a regular basis. And you have been doing this since 1992. I know they're done by telephone, is that correct?
Well, they're done by telephone now because we went in and took in cameras, and then they passed a law, you know, titled the Mumia Rule, that denied journalists access to prisoners with cameras. It was difficult to challenge, but we believe we should challenge it. We can challenge it. We just haven't had the resources to challenge it. So we're using the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a very interesting thing when we use the phone, when we go in and record, it's you can't do that more than a few times a year. I mean, it takes a lot of resources and money and time and travel to actually get your equipment there and go in and record and get out. And the other interesting thing about when we're only allowed to use the phone, the quality went down, and that was difficult. We had to figure out how to engineer it so that the quality sounds as good as possible. But it meant that he could call more often. And we found that actually having access via the phone has been really important for prisoners because it allows them to do contemporaneous reporting from inside, and it allows them to have a regular outlet that's much more than we could do if we had to travel to every single prison. So Prison Radio records about 47 people right now. Mumia is one of the most prolific, but they record a lot, and they're able to record as things are happening in the prison.
I'd like you to talk about the case. Let's go back to the 1970s. The shooting of the Philadelphia officer occurred in 1981. But talk about Mumia's experience growing up in the 70s in the city of Philadelphia.
It was an amazing time. Philadelphia was very vibrant, and the black newsrooms and the culture of reporting that was happening everywhere was very different than it is today. There were newsrooms in every single radio station mandated, I think, by the FCC. There were a lot of different community print outlets that were happening on a regular basis. It was so incredibly diverse and vibrant. He was involved in that. He was a political activist as well. When he was 14, he got involved in the Black Panther Party as part of his willingness to sacrifice his for his community and to bring things like free breakfast programs, sickle cell programs, medical programs. The content of what the Black Panthers were doing in the community were actual on-the-ground support systems for people who were desperately poor and who wanted to access services. So Mumia was part of that. And then he became a journalist. He became a journalist pretty quickly at the Black Panther Party paper. So by 16, he had a byline. So he was very active, and he continued to do community-based journalism in North Philadelphia and also for WHYY. So he was so talented that he was picked up by 10 stations as a radio reporter. He was doing TV interviews for WHYY. He was interviewing the Four Tops. He was interviewing Hugh Masekela, Bob Marley. He interviewed President Jimmy Carter. He did stuff on Three Mile Island. He was a amazing, talented, and very intrepid political reporter in the city of Philadelphia.
And with NPR.
National Public Radio, one of the guys who founded All Things Considered was his mentor at WHYY. He was one of the best journalists in America, and he was headed definitely to stardom.
And talk about the police department in Philadelphia in the 70s, and especially the police commissioner, Frank Rizzo.
People may not realize that the police departments in many places, but I know particularly Philadelphia, were vastly unchecked. They were jackboot occupational armies for the communities that they were serving. And they made no pretense about it. They did not actually think that was untrue.
Frank Rizzo encouraged brutality. I mean, it was truly a police state in Philadelphia at that time.
And not much has changed, because the sons of Frank Rizzo, the 6,500-member Philadelphia police force, have the same MO that they do today as they did then. But it was roughshod, run rampant. It was crime, corruption, and police scandal after scandal after scandal. So I've lived in Philadelphia now for 10 years. Every single week, there is an expose about a police scandal. This week, every single day, there's an expose about cops manipulating informants, cops planting evidence, cops robbing bodegas, cops creating false witness statements. Police officers, yesterday it was police officers raping and sodomizing witnesses. I mean, I kid you not, the headlines above the fold in Philadelphia are of a out-of-control Philadelphia Police Department run by Lodge 5 of the Fraternal Order of Police, and just devastating to communities. That is why we have the kind of incarceration rate we have here, and why Philadelphia is literally up south. Slavery was never abolished. And certainly these police forces are all about suppressing communities of color and creating a pipeline to prison.
And this was the issue. Mumia did not back away from reporting extensively about these injustices.
Rizzo got up on a podium and he surveyed a sea of 40 journalists. And he pointed to Mumia and he said, "You are the type of journalist that we are going to get." That's what Frank Rizzo said. And he said that because Mumia was unwilling to not tell the truth and to talk truth to power and to confront people. When you're working at a radio station or you're working in a newspaper, when you do reporting that really challenges the hegemony of the police state, which we're in, it is difficult to work. And here's an example of what Mumia did. He was at a press conference with Jimmy Carter, and they were talking about Three Mile Island and a bunch of other things. So Mumia raises his hand and he asks some really pointed question, and he gets this evil look from his boss. And he wasn't wearing a suit. He was kind of dressed a little, you know, not like a radio reporter. Sometimes radio reporters don't dress as well as other reporters. So he knew he was in trouble. So he gets in the elevator, and Jimmy Carter is in the elevator with the security guys, and his boss is standing next to him. And Jimmy Carter turns to him and he says, "Young man, I'd just like to thank you for those incisive and thoughtful questions." Jimmy Carter gets out of the elevator, and his boss turns to Mumia and he says, "Jimmy Carter, just save your ass, because I was going to fire you."
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it goes. And If you are standing in a press conference for the fraternal attorney or the mayor, and you say, "Excuse me, but that's false, and it was a lie, and it was proven a lie," you're going to have a hard time keeping your job.
And you know, Noel, I'm from Pennsylvania, and I remember the MOVE organization. And the Philadelphia police actually conducted a military assault, burning their row houses, killing 11 of the MOVE people, including 5 children. That was a horrific incident. And Mumia would not back down from exclusively covering the MOVE.
A story about that. Okay, so the police, when some of the MOVE people came home before the confrontation, the first one in 78 and then the other one where they bombed the house, when they confronted MOVE and the people who were coming home from prison, they brutalized all of them. And in that melee, they trampled and killed a baby who had been born at home, weeks old, Janine Africa's child. Mumia got a call. They said, "You got to come down. It's a story. It's breaking." And he didn't believe them, right? And he was like a regular journalist, just thinking, "Oh, this is just nonsense. You know, that didn't happen. It's not in the papers. Nobody's reporting it." And then he saw a picture in the local Black paper of a couple of politicians, Lucian Blackwell, I think, with the baby, you know, the coffin. And he was mortified. And he was like, "I will never again not go out and cover a story that needs to be covered." And then he became more involved, and he started listening, and he started talking to them, and he started actually recording what they had to say, which no one else really does. So that's the kind of thing that happens in Philadelphia. And the police, no one was charged. They said because the baby was not born in the hospital and there was no birth certificate, no murder had occurred.
Oh my gosh.
No wonder Move was pissed off.
Yeah. Yes.
I have to cut that out.
But not many people know about that. And
correct.
And everybody could Google it. Move, M-O-V-E, organization in Philadelphia in 1985 to see what the Philadelphia police did.
And there was a confrontation in 78 where there were 9 Move members given 30 to 100 years for friendly fire that has killed Officer James Ramp. 9 Move members were given 30 to 100 years. 2 passed away in prison and 2 have been released.
Mm-hmm.
But that still means that there are Move people in prison have done 40 years for a crime that they didn't commit because they were being totally attacked and victimized by Frank Rizzo's jackboot police force.
And then the FBI, Mumia was subject to their surveillance.
When Mumia was 14 years old, he was subject to their surveillance. He was reporting for the Black Panther paper, and he happened to go to a Hiroshima Day public event and do a speech, and they recorded it, and they put him on a security index.
So needless to say, he was monitored by the FBI, by Frank Rizzo, and pretty much the whole fraternal order of police in Philadelphia.
You know, what we can prove is that he was under surveillance. What we can prove is that Mumia resisted and was an intrepid and very valuable community member as a reporter. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence that goes to how much they were watching him. But he is also truly like every single Black man. He was treated the same way in prison and the same way outside of prison as every single Black man in Philadelphia. So when he was arrested that night after the shooting where he was shot and an officer was shot in this confrontation, it's unclear whether he was being targeted that moment, other than that he was being targeted because he was a Black man. And so when they realized who he was, yes, they changed their approach.
Thank you, Noel, for that background information about Philadelphia. I think that gives people an idea of the 1970s and just how brutal the City of Philadelphia Police Department was. I like to tell people that they can access the documentary that was done, and you were one of the producers, Noel Hanrahan, Mumia, Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal. It is a wonderful documentary with many voices, Cornel West, Angela Davis, Dick Gregory, Alice Walker, and others. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. My guest is Noel Hanrahan, who has recorded and broadcast commentaries by Mumia Abu-Jamal for the past 27 years. So how is Mumia right now? I know he's had some medical issues. Noel, how is he doing?
So Mumia is 64 years old, and so he has medical issues, and he's had some serious ones. He got hepatitis C. He became chronically debilitated by that. We were able to get him medical care through people, through really organizing across the country and the world, pushing the Department of Corrections to actually treat that. And so he was cured of hepatitis C, but he has residual issues. When you allow hepatitis C to become chronic and then what's called F4, where your liver is already being damaged, the protocol for the prisons was to allow people to become so sick. Well, once you do that, then you actually have lasting issues. You have liver damage, you have a higher increased rate of liver cancer, and you have other issues. So he's got some medical problems, and we're working on them and we're monitoring them. So like, he's got glaucoma, he's got cataracts, he's blind in one eye, he still has his skin rash condition that he has to monitor really super carefully, which is extreme psoriasis. He walks with a limp, you know, his feet aren't great. He's got high blood pressure, so he's got some issues. But, you know, I visit him a lot, and he presents as extremely vibrant. Like, if you go see him, you're like, yo, you're looking really good. And he goes, yeah, you know. And then I have to go through the list of what, you know, his medical things are. He goes, yeah, these are really a problem, and I'm monitoring them, and I'm walking a lot, and I'm trying to, you know, do what I can to eat in here, even though it's impossible to get healthy food there. But he's engaged. Like, he is getting his PhD. He's writing a phenomenal amount. Prison Radio is releasing his next book as the publisher in 4 weeks, and it's a 500-page volume called Murder Incorporated. America Manifest Destiny and Empire.
So, Noelle Hanrahan, let's turn to the current events in Mumia's case. In December 2018, the Philadelphia judge granted a new appeal to Mumia Abu-Jamal. So he regained his right to appeal. Is that correct?
Yes. So it's the very first time any judge on a trial level has given Mumia relief. So in order to get a new trial, in order to have a sentence overturned, he needs the Philadelphia, what's called a common pleas court, to rule in his favor. That's what Mumia got. So he got an order from Leon Tucker, a judge here, that reinstated 15 years of his appeals before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Now, what does that mean?
So Mumia had an original trial, and that original trial was conducted by Albert Szabo. And then Albert Szabo ruled on the very first appeal, his direct appeal. After that, this appeal went up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. The constitutional violation that was found by the U.S. Supreme Court and then translated to Mumia's case through the Leon Tucker ruling was that a district attorney could not sit on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, like the district attorney, Ron Castile, who was working on Mumia's appeal, not his original trial, but his appeals. He was then sitting on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and he was ruling on his own cases. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Williams, overturned that. And this local judge applied that ruling to Mumia. I mean, you know, it's more complicated than that, but not much more. Basically, he said the judicial canons of Pennsylvania require Ron Castile, a member of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, who was also a district attorney sitting on Mumia's appeals, to have recused himself. Now, at that moment when that happened, that's 15 years of appeals. It's not the original trial, but it's the appeals. So Mumia then gets back into court. And there were all the appeals that Mumia has had have denied the defense allowing to bring in new evidence. There is an enormous amount of evidence that Mumia is innocent. That has been denied by the courts for many years. It takes a scrubby and it just wipes off the whole whiteboard. Everything is gone. And it's now he has an opportunity to argue that this evidence is valid. He can re-argue like 100 pieces of evidence, which is crucial. And there are even more significant developments than that. So that's an amazing, life-changing seat.
So the Philadelphia judge, Leon Tucker, allowed Mumia to launch a new appeal. He ruled that the former Chief Justice Castile of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court should have recused himself from Mumia's previous appeals.
Exactly. It's way better than that. You know why? Because in this process, the judge, Leon Tucker, ordered the district attorney to search all of its files for relevant exculpatory evidence, for evidence that there was a connection between Castile and the case. In that process, the district attorney's office found in December, a few days after this ruling, 6 boxes of material from the original trial.
They just found it.
Those boxes, they just found them. It's a new district attorney. So it's a radical, revolutionary district attorney who was elected in January of last year, this past year. So he came across a storage facility that had boxes in it that had probably been there from when the offices were moved in 2000. These potentially have direct evidence of prosecutorial misconduct, police misconduct, or unconstitutional practices. So these could order a new trial immediately. Now, the Tucker ruling, that's going to take a few years. But these boxes could be like every movie you see, Hurricane Carter movie, the Guilford Four movie, you know, every movie you see about, everything you hear about innocence cases, oh, we found a box.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
We found a document. You know, this is the kind of thing. We found untested evidence. This is exactly what this could be.
So they are still going through those boxes to see exactly what is in there. Do you trust the outcome? Do you trust this new DA, Larry Krasner, who you call a revolutionary? He's against the death penalty. He's a civil rights attorney.
A civil rights attorney for Black Lives Matters groups. He was elected by a popular election. I think Larry Krasner has it in him to do an enormous amount and is trying to. I don't know that Mumia Abu-Jamal may get relief, but a lot of other people will. because Mumia is the third rail in Philadelphia politics. If Mumia gets relief, everyone else is going to get relief. You know, because he's going to be the toughest one. Krasner is under a lot of pressure, but he is also doing a lot of courageous things. So curiously, one thing he said was he appealed the order of Leon Tucker, which meant that Mumia had to spend years more appealing this decision, and he might get overturned at a higher court. So he stopped Mumia's appeal process. He stopped him from going back to court. He appealed, which was a very negative thing for Larry Krasner done last month. But in an interview with The Intercept, Larry Krasner said, I don't understand why they're complaining so much, because I gave you the boxes, which you could infer that that means that there's something in the boxes. Do I trust the DA? I trust that if he saw evidence of innocence, that he would bring it forward and that he would do that. But whether they have allowed there to be evidence of innocence, you know, whether they haven't scrubbed clean all those boxes for years, I don't know.
But what was his reason for challenging the order that gave Mumia the right to a new appeal? What was his reason?
It would affect too many people. There would be too much justice. It would affect such a wide variety of cases. It wouldn't only affect Mumia's case. It would affect all those who had been victimized by Ron Castile's impermissible.
Heaven forbid that we have justice.
Himself. Exactly. That's the point. But it's a difficult situation because we have had 40 years of mass incarceration. So he's running a district attorney's office who has been one of the most aggressive incarcerators. And so we have 47,000 people in Pennsylvania prisons, and we have an enormous amount of them from Philadelphia. So it's decades of corruption. So when we go to the district attorney's office and say we have a case where I can prove the guy's innocence and it's from 1981, they say we're only dealing with cases 2010 and forward because those are our current cases. They don't have enough manpower. Not an excuse, but it is what it is. I mean, he is. But I believe that Larry Krasner, when he sees the evidence of Mumia Abu-Jamal's innocence, will free him.
Wow. We can only hope and pray. Noelle, and on a personal note, how did you come to the idea in the early 1990s to record prisoners' voices?
There were two factors. I was working with political people who knew and were in relationship to U.S. political prisoners. And so there's a long tradition of Plowshares activists, Puerto Rican Independentistas, Black revolutionaries, Chicano revolutionaries, people who were taking a stand against the U.S. government's imperialist policies overseas and abroad and here. I knew that there existed U.S. political prisoners. Then the second level of it was I was a radio reporter. I mean, very much like Mumia in some ways, you think, like some access to information, consciousness, communities who were educating me. And I was a radio reporter. I was at KPFA in Berkeley, California. I was a radio reporter.
Oh, right.
And so I was covering the Robert Alton Harris execution in 1992 in April. And I thought that we couldn't do good journalism unless we talked to the people on the row. You can't cover a story without talking to the people it relates to. You can't kill somebody without actually seeing them as a full human being. Because that's what it means to be a reporter. You have to go to where the silence is. And the story is not a talking head talking about it. The story is people living it. And so I tried really for months and months and months and months to get somebody on the radio, and I couldn't. A lot of prisoners at San Quentin death row, which is, you could literally see it from KPFA radio. It was just across the water in Marin, and we're in Berkeley. And so, you know, we couldn't get the 600 guys on the row to talk to us. It was difficult because they didn't want to get their number bumped up. They didn't want to become, you know, the person who got a warrant the next. And there were a lot of people who weren't radio ready. So it was difficult, but I kept pushing it. So we did the report, and I thought, yeah, we won all these awards for our coverage, but it really missed the mark in that it didn't have an inmate on the air. So that July, I had heard of Mumia's work, and I took a bunch of recording equipment, and I flew out to Pennsylvania, and I put the microphone in front of him, and I had no idea that he was a trained radio reporter. I knew he sounded good, and I knew he wrote well, but I had no idea of his story. And when I did that, I was like, this is James Earl Jones in a box. This guy is amazing. He hadn't recorded in 11 years. I recorded him in July of 1992, and he was incarcerated and 81 arrested, and then had not been doing radio reports since. So when I put the mic in front of him, he was one of the best, most talented radio people I had ever recorded. He was really good. So that's how I started working with him. And then I went to Death Row in California and got women's voices out. And so I kept trying to bring into the mix more voices from inside. And then we got a lot of blowback. We got a lot of pressure. And when a reporter gets pressure, you know you're doing the right story.
Right.
So it was difficult to do, always.
What a remarkable story, Noelle. So thank you so much for being on Prison Pipeline and your continued work bringing Mumia's voice, his wonderful, insightful commentaries to the world. All of us at KABU wish him the very best, and thank you so much for being on Prison Pipeline.
You're welcome.
Again, the website is prisonradio.org. You have been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, Mike Fataklis, and thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. Up next is Rising Up with Sonali.
Tune in to KABU on Friday, March 8th for all-day special programming celebrating International Women's Day. For 24 hours starting at 5:30 a.m., the women-identified folk of KABU will create special programming celebrating the accomplishments and struggles of women. Again, that's International Women's Day, Friday, March 8th, here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Building Bridges to Sustainability. On Friday, March 8th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at PCC Cascade Campus in Portland. Building Bridges to Sustainability features keynote speakers, presentations, and breakout sessions where participants will have opportunities to gain insights to equity, economic opportunity, and social justice while shaping a culture of sustainability. Again, that's Building Bridges to Sustainability, Friday, March 8th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Portland Community College Cascade